The Allies intended the Nuremberg trials to bring Nazis to justice in the wake of the crimes they committed during World War II. The four powers involved in setting up the trials were Britain, France, the United States, and the Soviet Union. Recent research has brought to light the role of the Soviet Union in the trials. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. We're going to find out what the Soviets wanted to achieve with the Nuremberg trials, how successful Stalin was at controlling them, and what the outcome was. With me is Francine Hirsch, professor of history at the UW-Madison and author of the book Soviet Judgment at Nuremberg, published in 2020 by the Oxford University Press. And welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you, Norman. Really happy to be here.
Well, history has almost, gone past public consciousness, I think, of the Nuremberg trials, but what were they and who were the key players?
Great. So the International Military Tribunal, or IMT, this was the first of the Nuremberg trials, and it took place in the wake of a war, World War II, from November 1945 to October 1946 at the Palace of Justice in occupied Germany. The United States, Britain, France, and the Soviet Union, the four major Allied powers, tried 22 former Nazi leaders, people like Hermann Göring, Rudolf Hess, Joachim von Ribbentrop, and their organizations, organizations like the SS, the Gestapo, the High Command. And they tried them for conspiracy, crimes against peace, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. And I'll note, too, that this was it was the only four-power war crimes trial, but it wasn't really supposed to be that way. They were talking about doing many war crimes trials of this type, and the 12 subsequent Nuremberg trials were actually carried out by the United States alone.
When was this whole idea of an international military trial conceived? I mean, it happened so quickly after the war. There must have been some planning during the war.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, the usual story that we get here in the United States, in films, in memoirs, in docudramas, right, is that the United States came up with the idea of the trials and the main charges, and really focuses in on Robert H. Jackson, right, Supreme Court Associate Justice, as the driving force behind the whole thing. But in fact, it was the Soviets. It was the Soviet Union that pushed for a trial of the Nazi leaders, and they did so really early on in the darkest days of the war. In spring 1942, the Soviets are starting to think about this question of war crimes trials, about possibly how to hold them, and they're really prompted by the brutality of the Nazi invasion and the occupation, and early on also by the thought of reparations. It's in October 1942 that Soviet Foreign Minister Vyacheslav Molotov, he calls for, at the time, it's a special international tribunal. And he invites all interested governments, allied governments, to cooperate in bringing Hitler, Göring, and other Nazi leaders to justice. Now, this is, of course, highly theoretical at this point, right? This is pretty early on in the war still. And, these leaders haven't been... So really, this is aspirational. And the United States and Britain, early on, they're very slow to come on board to the idea. The British say, if there's going to be any kind of war crimes trials, that's just going to open the door to trouble, and there should be instead punishment by executive decree. And the U.S. government at the time, during the war especially, is very worried about, if they announce that there's going to be a tribunal, then there'll be reprisals against Allied prisoners of war. So really, the British and the Americans, they embrace the idea of a tribunal only when it's clear that the war was won.
Well, that does raise an interesting point. I mean, you're putting your witnesses at risk, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, your witnesses in the sense of, in what sense?
Well, in the sense that if the war is still going and these witnesses are still in the hands of the people you're going to accuse.
Right. I mean, early on, again, it's a question of, like, what is this trial going to look like? Will there even, be witnesses? Will the defendants have attorneys, right? So there, even early on when there's talk about this, there's different ideas about the kind of a trial.
Now, who came up with these concepts? Because I think they're new, aren't they, in 1946? Crimes against peace, crimes against humanity?
Yeah. So the three key charges that are set out in the Nuremberg Charter in Article 6, they're crimes against peace, so the crime of aggressive war, the crime of really waging a war of conquest. War crimes, so that's the more traditional charge, like going back to the Hague and Geneva Conventions, and crimes against humanity. Now, the Charter itself, it's drafted in London in the summer of 1945 at what's called the London Conference, and it's drafted by representatives of the four countries of the prosecution. And the indictment I'll mention included a fourth charge as well, conspiracy, which was turned into count one. But these ideas of crimes against peace and crimes against humanity, they really revolutionize international law. And in my book, I really focus in on the charge of crimes against peace, in part because it was the Soviet jurist, Aaron Tryinin, who had coined this term. Tryinin argued that Nazi leaders should be punished not just for war crimes, but for the crime of planning and waging a war of aggression, a war of conquest. And again, this is early on, even as the war is still going on, Soviet leaders begin to circulate Tryinin's ideas in articles in multiple languages, right, including English, and in radio broadcast, and eventually in a book called The Criminal Responsibility of the Hitlerites. And it's for me, as a historian, what's really interesting is like doing that work of tracing how ideas make the rounds. And what was really exciting for me in the Moscow archives was being able to see, in fact, these early discussions at the Institute of Law, where Tryinin was a member, about this concept of crimes against peace and how it developed over time. And then also tracing in U.S. archives how Tryinin's ideas traveled abroad. So it's, for me, super interesting. We see how Tryinin's book in a draft form makes its way to London, where it's discussed by the members of the United Nations War Crimes Commission. This is the Allied War Crimes Commission at the time. It's not what we know as later the United Nations. And then how it makes its way from London to the United States, where it's discussed by members of the War Department's Special Projects Branch, including Murray Bernays. Now, it's interesting. Murray Bernays, in older books about the Nuremberg trials, he's credited with coming up with this idea of crimes against peace. But from the Bernays archive in Wyoming, we could see how he actually read through Tryinin's reports and Tryinin's books, and it was working with that. And then how it made its way to the White House as well. So, you know, again, there's lots of talk, I should say, at this time about aggressive war, about treating war as a crime. But many European and American lawyers were really uneasy with ex post facto or retroactive law. And what happens when you end up bringing four different countries to the table with four different legal systems is, the Soviets had no problem with ex post facto law. So Tryinin ends up really taking the lead on this, and he then participates in the drafting of the Nuremberg Charter.
Now, were the Soviets particularly thinking about the treaty between Germany and Russia that then the Germans broke when they invaded Russia?
Oh, that is such a great question. No. I mean, and that's really got to be one of the biggest ironies of the story. Because in terms of one of the things once Nuremberg happens that the Soviets most want to hide are the secret protocols to the non-aggression pact, right? And the secret protocols to the non-aggression pact, in which Hitler and Stalin basically work out a deal to divide up Poland and the Baltic states and Finland, parts of Romania, right? That's clearly, according to Tryinin's own definition, that would be a crime against peace. So early on, even as they're doing these deliberations about the Nuremberg Charter, and then as they're moving forward, the four Allied powers, they're very careful to circumscribe everything to crimes committed by the Axis powers. And so again, I mean, the other really interesting thing here is a question for me, too, is a question of who knew what when. Who in the Soviet delegation, who among the Soviet lawyers, for example, actually knew about the secret protocols? So that comes up, too, as one of the big issues.
If it's not jumping ahead, the Germans, at least some of them, did say regarding that invasion of Russia that it was preemptive because they felt that or believed that or had reason to believe that the Russians were going to attack them anyway?
This becomes a huge issue over the course of the trials, right? I mean, if we think about, again, so just imagine, so from, again, because my research is from the perspective of the Soviet Union, what their expectations are early on, again, they're not expecting a very vigorous defense. Their model, quite frankly, is the Soviet show trial, where the defendants kind of read from a prepared script. And even though they don't think it's going to necessarily go quite that way, although that's what they're hoping early on, that it's sort of how they're envisioning things. And so they pretty soon come to understand that, yes, the defendants are going to be allowed to offer a real defense, that the defendants are going to have actual defense attorneys who they select. And almost half of them, by the way, choose for members of the Nazi Party as their defense attorneys, right?
So, yeah, right. Sympathetic voices.
Yeah, exactly. So that's part of what's going on, too, that the defendants are going to be allowed to bring in like all kinds of evidence, that they're going to be allowed to challenge the prosecution's evidence. That takes them by surprise as well, and that the defendants are going to be able to call witnesses too. And so as the trials are going along, so the way that things are structured is first you have for the first number of months, really from November until February, you have the prosecution presenting its case kind of by turns. So the Americans present and then the British present and then the French and then the Soviets. And then it's only in March that the defense case begins. And up until then, things had been going relatively smoothly. The four powers had been working pretty well together. And then when the defense case begins, It's first of all, it goes on far longer than anyone had anticipated, just for months and months and months. And Hermann Göring is allowed to go on and on for 2 weeks. And not only that, but the defendants, yeah, they bring in all kinds of witnesses. They bring in different kinds of evidence to challenge the prosecution's evidence. And one of the big things that a number of them focus on, Göring, Ribbentrop, on a whole number of the generals as well, right, is they contest this idea of aggressive war. They say that it was a war, a preventive war, a defensive war, like there's all kinds of vocabulary that's used for it. But basically, it's a matter of contesting this charge of crimes against peace. And they bring up the secret protocols, too. So that's, you know, that's another really big thing.
It seems that there were some other little tricky aspects to this as far as the Soviets were concerned that we've touched on, and that is, for want of a better term, Soviet war crimes?
Right. So, again, so in terms of what the expectations are at the very beginning, the Nuremberg Charter established that the IMT, the tribunal, is only going to address European Axis crimes. And that's not the only piece. The other thing is that the four chief prosecutors had also agreed before the trial started to try to keep their own country's war crimes out of the courtroom. This, for me, was a really interesting moment in reading. So I worked in the Soviet archives, and I also worked in some American archives as well. And what we see is the U.S. Chief Prosecutor Robert H. Jackson, he's the one who actually takes the initiative at a meeting before the trials start with the other prosecutors, the other chief prosecutors, and says, look, I have some information coming from intelligence sources that say that, you know, the defendants, they're going to be making all kinds of arguments bringing up the war crimes and the crimes against peace of the countries of the prosecution, in particular, focusing in on British and Soviet crimes against peace. And so he asks, actually, the other prosecutors to present him with, like, memoranda, basically, setting out any issues that their countries might want to keep out of the courtroom. So it's kind of remarkable. I mean, the British do it right away. The Soviets actually stall on this for a while. But the Soviets are still pretty confident that they're going to work together. It's not going to be an issue. They're not going to discuss Soviet war crimes in court, you know, or British war crimes or French war crimes, right? And the Soviets, even in some correspondence, they refer to this initiative of Jackson's and the agreement that they've come to. They call it their gentleman's agreement. They actually use this term.
How quaint.
I know, exactly.
Right out of World War what?
It was really eye-opening. So, you know, Moscow, of course, is concerned about the exposure of the secret protocols to the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. And the defense, of course, they brings them up, like, repeatedly. You know, Ribbentrop, who actually, you know, like, how are they going to keep it a secret? Ribbentrop is one of the signees. So, of course, he brings it up during his testimony and calls witnesses to talk about it. The defense also brings up French war crimes and British crimes against peace. And the prosecution is unable to shut this down because the Western judges, they are determined to make sure that this is seen as a fair trial. Like, already at this time, there's all kinds of talk in the press, right, among attorneys, that the Nuremberg trials, that this is victor's justice.
Right.
And the judges, like, that's on their radar. They're worried about this. And so they want to make sure that the defendants have their day or, you know, months, as it turns out, in court, right? And so that's what happens. So it's one of these things where, you know, Allied war crimes are supposed to be skirted and not talked about, right? But that's not what happens at all. Katyn, by the way.
The forest,
yeah. That is another matter entirely.
Literally a cover-up.
And just unbelievable. So again, it's one thing to try to prevent war crimes from coming up in court, right? All of the Allied powers are involved in this, quite frankly. It's another thing. This is a Soviet effort to blame one of their own atrocities on the Nazis and to use the Nuremberg trials to do this.
So the numbers are staggering. As many as 10,000 Polish officers in captivity who were executed and buried in the Katyn Forest.
Yeah, some of the new numbers are actually, I think I've heard 22,000 most recently. I mean, the numbers are staggering. So it's a massacre of Polish prisoners of war in the Katyn Forest outside Smolensk. And it's a political hot potato, right, from wartime. It's really in April 1943 that Radio Berlin announces the discovery of mass graves and blames the Soviets. And the Soviets claim that, you know, the Nazis are responsible and that the Nazis had committed the atrocity in the summer of 1941 after taking the region. Now we all know now, like, clearly that Soviet security forces did it, right? But at the time, there's a lot of talk about, well, what's the truth behind it? And Moscow decides to use Nuremberg. And so, again, watching this unfold through the archival documents for me was fascinating because Rudenko, the Soviets, include Katyn in, like, a rewrite of the indictment. And the Western prosecutors, they have their questions about whether this is a Nazi crime or not, right? And they try to get Rudenko, the Soviet chief prosecutor, to not include it. They say, oh, is this too complicated? Like, that's not included. It's just going to raise all kinds of questions. And
No doubt.
Yeah, like, let's just not go there. And Rudenko says, I have no choice, right? And he did have no choice. He tells them that if this doesn't go through, I'm going to have to go back to Moscow and talk to Stalin. Stalin's not going to like it. This is all going to take a lot of time, and it's going to delay the start of the trials. And the Western prosecutors say, well, like, okay, I mean, not, they give in. And it's a day or two after the indictment is published that that the American and British prosecutions get some more just secret memoranda from their intelligence services telling them that, you know what, pretty likely the Soviets did it. We have pretty clear evidence now, but it's already in there. It's kind of too late.
The sheer numbers, I mean, we mentioned Katyn, tens or perhaps 20,000 of Polish officers executed. The numbers are really staggering, though, just in terms of the war in general. If we compare, for example, what the Soviets lost in the war compared to what the other Allied powers lost, how do the numbers stack up?
Well, again, this is one of those things where in trying to make sense of the Soviet position, right, the Soviets lost 27 million people in the war. Two-thirds of those people were civilians. think the American forces, the number is, it's 440,000, something along those lines, right? So that's a pretty vast difference.
And very few, some, but relatively few civilians,
comparatively. So that's 25,000 Soviet citizens were left homeless, right? That's in addition to those killed. It's complete destruction of the Soviet infrastructure, of factories, cities, cultural monuments. I mean, really just, and again, that's part of why they're thinking early on about the need for reparations, because of the need to
rebuild,
right? And also just some kind of a trial, just what they've suffered, and then what they've suffered like just through the occupation as well. So the numbers are staggering, and the numbers again help shape what they think the trials are going to be like and what their idea of justice is. Now, it doesn't justify them trying to blame a crime that the Nazis committed, right? I mean, a crime that they committed on the Nazis. But for them, they're just going to add it in and just get rid of this difficult political problem of Katyn by doing it that way. I just want to add one more thing about Katyn, which I think is really important, which is that they don't get away with it. The Soviets don't get away with it. So it's included in the indictment. But again, one of those things about the judges insisting on a fair trial, the defense is allowed to call three witnesses to counter Soviet evidence, which, by the way, was fabricated about Katyn. And the Soviets are also allowed to call three witnesses, and there's kind of a showdown of witnesses. And in the end, it's kind of like, it's not really clear, like, who did it, right? It's so unclear that Katyn is not included in the judgment. It kind of just disappears.
Shadow of a doubt department.
Yeah, exactly. So one of those ways in which they try and that doesn't work for them.
Well, let's look at what the Soviets wanted out of the trials when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland. With me is Francine Hirsch, professor of history at the UW-Madison and the author of the recently published book, Soviet Judgment at Nuremberg. And we're looking at those trials, those post-World War II trials, which involved the four Allied powers taking to task the Axis powers, Germany in particular, for crimes against the peace, crimes against humanity during World War II. And Fran, your research has emphasized the Soviet role in this trial, and what did the Soviets want? I mean, after these staggering losses that you just described that the Soviets had experienced compared even to the other allies, what did they want out of these trials?
Right. So initially, the Soviet goal is reparations, or at least that's one of the big Soviet goals. But before the trials even start, at the Potsdam Conference in August 1945, some key questions about reparations are settled. It's established at Potsdam that each of the Allied powers occupying Germany would be able to extract reparations in its own way, like that's the word, the wording in quotes, from its occupation zone. So the Soviets know that, okay, they're going to get reparations, although that becomes a big contentious issues, but separate from Nuremberg. The Soviets also, though, share with the other Allied powers, first of all, the goal of bringing the Nazis to justice, also increasing their international influence, right? They see Nuremberg as a forum, as a way for them, like they've won the war, and now they believe that they deserve their seat at the table, right? And they also hope to shape the narrative of the war. And there's also, of course, the goal of collective catharsis, which I think cannot be underestimated as well. So, you know, so those are the goals. And again, like all of the Allied powers want to achieve many of these things, but really they have different ideas about justice. They have different ideas about what the narrative of the war should look like, right? The United States really wants to highlight the rule of law. The Soviets, though, you know, they take Nazi guilt as a given. From the very beginning, they are expecting hangings down the line. They want to use the tribunal to demonstrate Nazi guilt and to tell a story about Soviet suffering and heroism. they really see Nuremberg as an exercise in what people have called like didactic justice, really a kind of a show trial model. And again, I'll just note that I think it's really notable that almost the entire Soviet legal team at Nuremberg, the prosecutors, the chief judge, they're connected to the Soviet show trials of the 1930s. The Soviet judge, Yona Nikitchenko, he had been a judge in the Moscow trials of the mid-1930s. These were the trials that Stalin had used to take down his political enemies. The Soviet chief prosecutor, Roman Rudenko, he had been a prosecutor in show trials in the 1930s in Ukraine, right? And they're chosen for Nuremberg because they have this kind of experience. And Stalin also appointed the Soviet Union's deputy foreign minister, Andrei Vyshinsky, who had been the prosecutor in the Moscow trials, as the head of the Soviet Union's secret Nuremberg Commission, which was based in Moscow. And they kind of had this idea that they were going to be able to control what's happening in Nuremberg, you know, up from Moscow, which was not going to happen. But again, that's the aspiration.
How much control did Stalin have over the trials? Well, wasn't he really just in favor of pretty much summary executions?
No, not at all. So, again, the Soviets are the ones who are pushing for the trials. They want hangings down the line, but, you know, they want a big trial first, right? So that's part of their goal. And in terms of Stalin's control, I mean, Stalin wants to control the trials. He's counting on controlling the Soviet delegation. He's kept in the loop about just about everything. Stalin sets up two secret Nuremberg commissions based in Moscow to oversee the Soviet delegation and the Soviet case. The first is that commission I mentioned that was headed by Andrei Vyshinsky, and that included leaders from all of the branches of the Soviet security apparatus, and also included kind of the highest ranking members of Soviet legal institutions like the Soviet Supreme Court. So that was one of the commissions. There's also another commission, another secret commission called the Politburo Commission for the Nuremberg trials that was headed by Foreign Minister Vyacheslav Molotov and included some of the same personnel. And again, the Politburo is one of the highest party organs in the Soviet Union. So, you know, these are the people at the top. And so again, Stalin wants to keep tabs on things. Everything's supposed to be highly centralized, lots of back and forth. And there are a number of key moments when Stalin really does try to intervene. Like one of those moments is the crafting of the indictment. There's all this back and forth, and the Soviets in delegation in Nuremberg, they're sending drafts of the indictment back, and they want to make sure that it doesn't include too much about the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, right, as a cause of the war. They don't want that to include that at all, right, of
right.
course. And so, you know, in the archives, I was able to see how this document makes us all the way up from Vyshinsky to Molotov to Stalin. And Stalin, you have Stalin's handwriting on it and, you know, notations and Stalin's tips for negotiating. Like, you know, you should stand firm on this issue, but not on that one. Or, you know, pretend to support the British in this, but, you know, support them because you really want them to support you on that. So it's so interesting. And also, he's really involved in, or tries to be involved in the crafting of the judgment. Because again, Stalin wants guilty verdicts down the line. And this, for me, was also a really interesting moment. Because so the Soviet judge, Yona Nikitchenko, and then the Western judges, so the four judges and their alternates, they're supposed to be deliberating on the judgment in complete isolation. Right, complete isolation.
Right.
Like the garbage is taken out of the room and burned every night.
but Stalin still has his finger in the pie.
Nikitchenko, the Soviet judge, manages to smuggle a draft copy of the indictment and the verdicts to Moscow. I saw it in the Moscow archives.
Wow.
Yeah. And not only that, but then again, the same team, the same crew, you got Vyshinsky, you've got Molotov, you've got Stalin, you got the members of the Soviet security apparatus. They're passing this document around and sending Stalin these kind of memoranda recommending changes. Because again, the draft of the judgment and the verdicts is not calling for hangings down the line. And so the Soviets, with Stalin's signature at the end, they send Nikitchenko back a 12-page ciphered telegram with instructions again, about how he should be negotiating and making the other judges understand. He's supposed to make, you know, Judge Jeffrey Lawrence, who's the British judge and also the president of the tribunal, he's supposed to make him understand. There's like this great line about how the world will not settle for a soft-hearted judgment, right, when the guilt of the defendants is so, you know, and so on. But, you know, really, there's a lot of wishful thinking, too, right, in terms of Stalin's ability to control. And what I found in my research is that this effort to control things, this effort to, again, like sign off on everything, send these documents back, get instructions, the Soviet prosecutor and judge are not supposed to make decisions on their own, right? This really deprives them of necessary flexibility. You know, sometimes documents get lost in transit. Sometimes instructions arrive too late to be of any use at all. And so, again, Rudenko and Nikitchenko, the prosecutor and judge, there's a lot of moments where they're just kind of left scrambling because they're waiting for word from Moscow.
And holding up the whole trial.
And holding up the whole trial, yeah. There's this crazy incident right before the trial is going to start where Rudenko pretends to have malaria as a way of, right, of trying to push for a delay.
A well-chosen disease.
A well-chosen disease, absolutely.
You mentioned earlier that word catharsis in terms of being an aspect of these Nuremberg trials. Did that catharsis come out in the less formal relations among the participants? Not the defendants, obviously, but the prosecutors?
There is so much alcohol.
This is the Soviets we're talking about here.
Oh, this is everyone, really.
Everyone's
drinking. There is so much alcohol. You know, there's whiskey, there's vodka, there's brandy, there's cordials. There's so much alcohol. And everyone's drinking. You know, not during the trial, but after hours. And, you know, so the trials would end at 5, and then people would go off and do whatever, like explore the city, go to the bars, go to the Grand Hotel, where there would be cabarets and live music, go to the bars. So again, so it's the correspondents, the journalists, there were a bunch of bars that they would hang out in. And so there's lots of great stuff in letters and memoirs about the Soviets and the Western correspondents playing chess together, right, even if they sometimes didn't speak the same language. But the kinds of parties that the prosecutors and the judges and the other members of the Soviet legal team went to me, that part of the story is really interesting because I started off thinking that this was just kind of interesting, like, you know, color to the story. But then you realize, after all, this is not just color to the story. This is a really crucial part of the story. Like, this is sometimes what we need to be looking at when we look at tribunals, right, or these kinds of big events. Because there are moments, there are these kind of turning point moments that happen while everyone's imbibing alcohol. You know, there's this point where this Vyshinsky secret commission, right, they want Rudenko to reach an agreement with the other chief prosecutors to share their speeches in advance because the Soviets want to know what the other prosecutors are going to be saying, right?
Sure.
And Rudenko does manage to reach that agreement, like while they're drunk. And he writes the next day, he lets Vyshinsky know, like, all is good. And, you know, so it's that kind of thing. There's also some really awkward moments in terms of the socializing. One of my favorite moments, so, you know, Andrei Vyshinsky, deputy foreign minister, head of one of the Soviet Union's secret Nuremberg commissions. He goes to Nuremberg from Moscow. Remember, the commission's supposed to oversee things from afar. But in November, soon after the trial start, word gets out that the defendants are going to be introducing the secret protocols. And part of the problem is that Roman Rudenko, the Soviet chief prosecutor, he doesn't know the full story. They've kept him in the dark about quite a bit. So Vyshinsky goes to Nuremberg in part to fill in Rudenko and the rest of the Soviet delegation about some of the secrets of Soviet foreign policy. And, you know, he's deputy foreign minister, so what do? Like, everyone throws parties. And so there's a big party, and that's thrown by one of the Western powers in Vyshinsky's honor. And, you know, Vyshinsky shows up and proposes, like, a toast, you know, and the toast is something along the lines of, like, to the defendants, may their paths go straight from the courthouse to the graves. But the Soviets had problems with translators, And in this case, this was not translated until after the Western judges drank, and the Western judges were appalled. So,
yeah. I can see where they would be.
Yeah.
They wouldn't play too well in a court in this country today.
No.
We're talking about 1946 now, with all kinds of sources for evidence. What kind of evidence was presented?
So the prosecution is presenting its case from November 45 up through February 46. And again, it's in terms of the order of things as the Americans go, and then the British and the French and the Soviets. And one of the problems for the Soviets is that, because they're going last, is that the Americans end up taking a very long time to present their evidence, and present lots of evidence, tons of documentary evidence. There's teetering piles of documentary evidence. The Americans had captured a number of German archives, including the archive of the German Foreign Office and the Military High Command. And so they take their time presenting all of this documentary material. The Americans also start calling witnesses, which the Soviets were not expecting this. They had some idea that maybe witnesses would be called later after everyone presented their cases. So the Americans, they call Major General Erwin Lahusen, the former German military intelligence officer. And this is like, it's a huge sensation. He had been part of the plot to assassinate Hitler. And so it's one of those big moments in court with lots of suspense and lots of drama, right? They, all of the countries of the prosecution, they call, again, it's witnesses. There's some film footage. There's depositions of eyewitnesses. I would say one of the most powerful parts of the trial, again, and this is just from reading the transcript, but also from reading letters and memoirs and having a sense of how people experience things in real time, was the French and Soviet eyewitnesses. And the French eyewitnesses testified in February, and then the Soviet eyewitnesses also at the, I think in January, actually, the French and the Soviets in February. And the way that it's split up, it's the French and the Soviets who have the main responsibility for presenting the cases on war crimes and crimes against humanity. And they bring in eyewitnesses then to testify. The French bring in eyewitnesses to testify about Auschwitz and the other concentration camps. The Soviet witnesses testify about crimes against humanity in the occupied East. So, again, lots of different types of evidence. And, you know, the documentary evidence would have been enough, right? There's certainly enough of it, certainly more of it than anyone had anticipated. But it's the eyewitnesses, I think, who really make the most impact in terms of giving the people in the courtroom, and I think just even for the historical record, giving a sense of what people had experienced.
And the film, too?
The film footage as well. There are a number of films that are shown, and that's also incredibly powerful. But nothing as much as the eyewitnesses.
Well, we'll look at the defense and the outcome of the Nuremberg trials when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Francine Hirsch, professor of history at the UW-Madison and author of the recent book, Soviet Judgment at Nuremberg. And we're looking at those post-World War II trials, bringing Axis powers to trial for crimes against the peace, crimes against humanity, and myriad other charges, large and small, I'm guessing. What kind of defense did the Germans, in fact, were they all Germans, what kind of defense did they have?
So they were all Nazis. Some of them were Austrians, right? They were all under the category of European Axis war criminals. But this was the trial of the Nazis. And again, at the very beginning, they're imagining that there will be additional trials of other Axis war criminals. So, but this one is focused on the major German war criminals, some Austrians. And in terms of the kind of defense that they had, the short answer is, you know, robust. Much more of a defense, again, than the Soviets were anticipating. I mean, probably much more of a vigorous defense than any of the prosecutors were anticipating. And that partly had to do with the fact that, they had top-notch defense attorneys, most of them, and they were able to call witnesses, and the judges were determined again to hear their case, to let them have their say in court. The longer answer, of course, is that there were different strategies and tactics, right, that were taken. And a number of the defendants really set out to disprove this charge of crimes against peace, as we were talking about earlier, to argue that the war was preventive. Others, including SS leader Ernst Kaltenbrunner, they just denied, right? Denied knowledge of crimes against humanity, claimed that they didn't know about the death camps. Kaltenbrunner's signature was on a whole number of documents, and he kept claiming again and again that someone had forged it.
Right. Oh, yeah. Sure.
Sure. Of course. Right. You know, others claim that they were insignificant. Like Hans Fritzsche, that he was his attorney said he was too insignificant he wasn't at all those big meetings. And to some extent, in his case, you know, maybe there was some truth to that. Military leaders, there were a bunch of different defenses. Some of which they said that it wasn't up to them to make political decisions. Right. That their job as military leaders was to follow the orders, come up with the military plans. Now, defense of following orders was kind of thrown out, but it didn't stop them from making that defense in court. There were other cases, too, some of which I think were really interesting, like the case of the admirals, like Admiral Karl Dönitz, who claimed that certain practices, like sinking ships without warning, right, submarine warfare, that those, in fact, had become customary, that everyone was doing it. And they actually brought in evidence from the Americans to prove, in fact, that this, in fact, had become customary. And in the end, that charge is not one of the things that they include for him in the judgment. So, again, there's a range, right, 22 defendants, lots of different attorneys with lots of different strategies, and sometimes the attorneys are working together, but there's also tension and a question of, well, whose responsibility, you know, really was it, and some of the defendants will bring in witnesses that'll again sort of suggest that the person that they're there for was not guilty, but that other defendants were.
Well, now in the case of a couple of them, Rudolf Hess and Albert Speer, I mean, they were convicted, but they were not executed. What kind of range of punishments was the prosecution seeking?
Yeah, well, that's really interesting. So again, in terms of what the prosecution is seeking, it again differed by country. The Soviet prosecution was seeking, you know, guilty verdicts and hanging down the line. And again, as in terms of then the judge's discussions, the Soviet judge was also insisting on guilty verdicts and hanging down the line. But I think the real interesting discussion about the sentencing, that was left to the judges, right? And the judges go back and forth about a whole number of the defendants. Hess is a really interesting case. Rudolf Hess, you know, Hitler's deputy, at the very beginning, he claimed to have amnesia. He would basically sit in the courtroom reading mystery novels and, you know, and would just act really erratic and ended up not testifying. And then at a certain point, he declares that he's cured of amnesia or that he never had amnesia. And so that has its own, you know, they bring in psychiatrists to examine him. It's a whole big thing. Speer and Schock, there are a number of defendants who, part of their defense is that they had come to see that Hitler was wrong, or they had come to see that that things had gone too far and had tried to stop things. And so, you know, Speer is involved in an attempted assassination, an attempt to assassinate Hitler. Schock, basically, he's kicked out from his position. And so some of them, it's... that comes up as well about whether that should go into discussions about sentencing. So it's the discussions of the judges are also really, really interesting to follow. The Western judges actually had serious reservations about some of the charges overall. So remember, a conspiracy is added as count one in the indictment. And the tribunal ends up completely reformulating the conspiracy charge in the end. The Western judges, they reject the prosecution's argument that the conspiracy began with the creation of the Nazi Party in 1920. Instead, in the judgment, they date the conspiracy, its start, to November 5, 1937. That's the date of the Hossbach Conference at which Hitler had revealed to his generals his plans to invade neighboring countries. And that's not the only thing. They end up limiting the conspiracy to the planning and waging of crimes against peace. So the conspiracy does not then include war crimes and crimes against humanity. So that's part of what happens. And, you know, Moscow, as these deliberations are going on, of course, they see the acquittals coming and, you know, they want to intervene, but that's to no avail. You know, ultimately, 12 of the defendants out of the 22 are sentenced to death by hanging. Three are acquitted, Schacht, Papin, and Fritzsche, and the others, including Hess, receive prison sentences. You know, Nikitchenko, in the end, he files a dissent, which was something the other judges did not want to have happen. They really wanted unanimity, but that was not going to be the case.
What was the relationship between what must have been the very beginnings of the Cold War and those Nuremberg trials?
Yeah, no, it's... I love thinking about that. You know, that was when I first started working on the book, it was clear to me that the Cold War was really key to the story. And when I would initially start talking about the book, I would talk about how, well, part of the story is it's the Cold War, right, shaping the Nuremberg trials, and part of it is also how Nuremberg shapes the beginnings of the Cold War. So, you know, tensions between the United States and the Soviet Union, they're there all along. That's pretty much as soon as Truman comes into office. And Jackson himself and a whole number of members of the the American prosecution team, they're anti-communist. But they keep things under wraps and congenial, right? And then, remember, the defense case starts many months later after the prosecution's case in March. And March 5th, 1946, well, that's the date that, you know, former British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, he gives his Iron Curtain speech in Fulton, Missouri. And in this speech, he calls for Anglo-American resistance to Soviet tyranny. Now you say, oh, what does that have to do with the Nuremberg trials? He's in Fulton, Missouri, right? Well, in Nuremberg, the very next day, March 6th, that's when the defense case begins. And when the Soviets get to the courtroom that morning on March 6th, there are copies of the U.S. Army newspaper Stars and Stripes scattered everywhere.
Fascinating.
Yeah. And the headline reads, "Unite to Stop Russians."
Sounds like a clarion call.
Yeah, no, exactly, right? And the defense attorneys, they're holding up copies like over their shoulders for their clients to read. And the Soviet memoirs, they're really good on this. There's a great line in one of the memoirs quoting Goering as basically saying, well, you know, this is great for us because now the Western prosecutors are all unified against the Soviet Union, and the Soviets, they really start to feel this. From this moment, again, the defense case starts, the defense is feeling energized and really determined to drive a wedge further between the Soviets and the Western powers. And they have lots of success in the weeks and months that follow. Again, this is where, you know, Goering talks about the war against the Soviet Union being preventive, and Ribbentrop brings in the secret protocols. Ribbentrop says in his testimony, hey, if we're guilty of crimes against peace, and the Soviets certainly are too. And this is, too, where I think the socializing is important in Nuremberg for keeping things moving along. Nikitchenko, he played tennis with the other judges. they're spending free time together. And so that keeps things going okay. But in Moscow, from this point, during the defense case, the Soviet leaders, the members of these Soviet secret commissions, they start interpreting decisions that go against Soviet interests after that. And there are many 3-to-1 votes of the judges, right, against Nikitchenko.
Allies versus Soviets.
Yeah.
Allies versus Soviets.
Exactly. And especially like it's an Anglo-American anti-Soviet plot. That's the way the Soviets talk about it, too. So, you know, again, this just it becomes part of the tensions then, right, of the Cold War.
Did you use newly available material from the Soviet archives to research your book, Soviet Judgment at Nuremberg?
Yeah, I could not have written this book without the Moscow archives. It was doing this archival research. There was really provided so much in terms of critical behind-the-scenes details and missing parts of the story. So I worked in, I did research in 5 different archives in Moscow. There's also in the state archive, there were all these surveillance reports. This to me was also really interesting.
Soviets spying on Soviets.
Soviets spying on Soviets. It's just, it's constant. This is what they, you know, this is what they do. They just kind of move their system of spying on each other, right, from Moscow to Nuremberg. So it's members of the Soviet delegation, like editors of the press and writers, they're sending very detailed reports back to Moscow reporting on what the other members of the Soviet delegation are doing. And this is where I learned about how much shopping was happening on the black market.
Shopping.
Exactly. And again, like those little things, that's where I learned that the British and the Americans were apparently making fun of the clothing that the female members of the Soviet delegation were wearing. There were a lot of hurt feelings. You know?
No detail overlooked in those surveillance.
The other parts would go on. So that stuff is just great. And again, we can ask a little, well, how does this really help us understand the Nuremberg trial? But it does, because it's part of that whole atmosphere.
The cultural divide.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Then, of course, the Foreign Ministry archive, it was critical. I mean, that's where I was able to see marked up drafts of the indictment and the judgment. And it's also where I got to see amazing secret telegrams with just like a blow by blows of the ups and downs of the trials. There's some amazing telegrams. Again, that was like went on and on for pages. And one of them, it was by a diplomat who sends this back like right after the revelation of the secret protocols in court, right, which is a really big deal for the Soviets. And this informant, he complains, and it goes something like the Soviet Union, like, you know, we're a country of victors, and like we went to Nuremberg to prosecute the fascists. And then he says, and instead, like, we've become the object of their provocative attacks. And so then this is what they're, you know, this is what Stalin's reading. So those sources are great. There was also the Academy of Sciences archive where I got to, again, read the drafts of Trianon's report. And one of my favorite archives to work in was the Archive of Literature and Art. Those materials are amazing for just getting a sense of the human side of the story. That's where I saw a lot of materials of some of the Soviet correspondents, and it's just so rich. So the Soviet filmmaker Roman Karman was in Nuremberg making a documentary of the Nuremberg trials, and also his studio had put together some of the Soviet documentary evidence of atrocities. And Karman's diaries are amazing. You get this sense of his first impressions of coming into Nuremberg and seeing, you know, the shattered city, and his first impression of Goering when he sees him in court for the first time. And he talks a lot about the food and how bad the food is.
Okay.
So again, like the mundane, but that's like, I don't know, it makes it so much more real.
What sort of precedent did the Nuremberg trials set, if you can summarize it in a minute?
1 minute, uh-oh. So first of all, I would say that the Nuremberg trials really, it opened up a wide-ranging conversation about how international law might be expanded to protect humanity from its worst impulses. Right after Nuremberg, there's a big movement for what at the time is called the progressive development of international law, and Nuremberg is one of the big sparks to that. It also set the precedent that waging aggressive war, a war of conquest, right, was a criminally punishable act, and it also laid the foundation for new laws and institutions, again, that to protect human rights and humankind, right? What I want to say, too, is one of the things for me about bringing in the Soviets and really understanding Nuremberg's Cold War context is that it also helped me understand why Nuremberg's promise, I think, was never fully realized. That efforts afterwards in the United Nations to codify the principles of the Nuremberg Charter, like, you know, crimes against humanity, crimes against peace, and to use that as a first step towards creating like a more robust international law, those deliberations stalled, partly over the question of enforcement and big questions about state sovereignty. And those concerns about state sovereignty have never gone away.
Well, Francine Hirsch, you've done certainly a commendable job of putting a human face on the Nuremberg trials and also summarizing them for us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun.
I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.